Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. I want to build a better American labor movement, one worker at a time, my guest today announces on his LinkedIn page. For Dave Camper, Gustavus class of 96, these are not mere words. He's been active in the labor movement for some 20 years with the American Federation of Teachers, the Illinois Federation of Teachers, Education Minnesota, and most recently, the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, or MAPE. In 2021, Dave left MAPE for the Economic Policy Institute, where he is Senior State Policy Coordinator for that organization's Economic Analysis and Research Network, or EARN. In addition to his organizing work, Dave has written extensively, and in my view, quite incisively, about labor issues for such online and print publications as In These Times, Labor Notes, Jacobin, Strikewave, and The Forge, whose editorial collective includes him. Following Gustavus, where I'm proud to say he double majored in history and communication studies, Dave earned his MA and PhD in history from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He also holds an MS in labor studies from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He was Sangamon County, Illinois coordinator for Barack Obama's presidential campaign in 2007 and served also on that county's board for 2.5 years. Here in Minnesota, he currently chairs the board of the new Brookwood Labor College in St. Paul. Dave is one of the experts I rely on for thoughtful analysis of labor issues and related topics, both in Minnesota and beyond, and I'm delighted he could join me to talk about the movement now and ahead, labor law and workers' rights, organizing efforts among Amazon workers, the impact of the COVID pandemic on workers' conditions and prospects, and his own journey to and beyond Gustavus. So welcome, Dave. It's great to have you on.
Thank you. I will never live up to that introduction.
Oh, you've more than lived up to it. Are you kidding me? I left some stuff out. But yeah, it's great. I know we saw each other in person some years ago when you came. You kindly came to a history alumni panel, but we haven't actually connected in person for a while. So it's great to connect, reconnect this way. First of all, just in general, how are things going with you and COVID? How's that? Are you working at home? What are you from home?
Yeah, well, I am. I switched, as you said in the introduction, I switched just a year ago now to the Economic Policy Institute, which is based in Washington, D.C., but they actually hired me as permanently remote. So I will now be working out of my home, you know, forever, aside from occasional trips around the country and to D.C.
But okay.
My wife, Joanne Biederman Camper, also Gustavus 96, and I, we are both real homebodies. So we have had a much easier pandemic than a lot of other people.
Okay.
We don't have small kids at home. We have our streaming on TV. We have cats. And thankfully for us, we've been very fortunate.
And you said cats, I think, plural. How many? Two?
Since we're on a public podcast and there's a legal limit in the city of Brooklyn Park, I will point out that my wife is a veterinarian and cats 4 and 5 are technically still fosters, even though we've had them for a year. And we have five,
okay.
which is plenty, but they're
that's
all
plenty. We had one and a dog, which was plenty and fun. And by the way, Dr. Biederman, Joanne, your spouse, she is also, correct me if I've got this right or wrong, she's the niece of alum and Civil War historian Jim McPherson, right? Is the niece or is that right?
Yes.
She's the niece.
She and I were about 6 months into dating. And this was, we started dating in 2008, so long after we left Gustavus. And she says to me, six months we've been dating. Oh, you know, I'm related. You know, one of my uncles is an historian who I think is kind of well known. I think he won a prize of some sort. Do you know James McPherson? And of course, then I had to pick my jaw up off the floor. He's Uncle Jim, though that's from his Joanne's mom is from a very large family. So Uncle Jim is, I think, 15 years older than her mom.
Right, that's right.
No, he's a bit older. Of a distant figure.
Yeah, and Judy Biederman, Joanne's mom, she and her husband Larry, they're going to come to a dinner. I'm trying to bring David Blight, the historian, so Pulitzer Prize winning biographer of Douglas. He's supposed to come on April 11th to Gustavus and in honor of Jim. Jim won't be there, but Judy and Larry will be there. Actually, I'll send you and Joanne the invitation as well, or the notice, the flyer, whatever it's called. Anyway, small world always. It's funny because you didn't know Joanne at Gustavus, right? Or did you?
We did. We were friends, but not like particularly close. Okay. We were part. There was an improvisational comedy troupe at Gustavus at the time that we were in called the Questionable Improv, that used to perform down at that coffee shop that I think was called the Chestnut Tree.
Oh yeah, the Chestnut Tree. Sure, no longer there, but it was great. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we were in that together, and we were friends, but we weren't in any way particularly close. And then okay. We didn't see or hear from each other for a dozen years. And reconnected on Facebook. And before you knew it, we fell in love.
That's funny. And five cats later, here you are. So, that's great. And exactly. By the way, I'll be podcasting with her as well, with Dr. Biederman, Joanne. I look forward to that also. So again, welcome. Let's, I have a, start with your background. We get to the, congrats on the new gig at EPI. We'll get to that. But am I remembering correctly? Are you from, you have an Illinois connection as I do or not?
Yes, I grew up in the Chicago suburbs, Crystal
like
Lake
me.
On the
okay,
northwest
yeah.
side. Yeah, what
right.
suburb did you grow up in?
I grew up in Park Forest, so south side.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And I came to Gustavus. I'm trying to think of this. I wanted to be able to tell a really good story of the journey that got me to come to Gustavus. And what it really comes down to is there was a really effective Midwest recruiter whose name was Tanya Bergman. I think she was just an alum who did it for her own. I think she was a volunteer, but she was such an enthusiast for the college that I went up and took a visit, and she would follow up with us, and it just became the right place for me to go. So I came to Gustavus largely because of a really good recruiter.
That's great. It's so funny. And so I was right. I thought you and I had the Illinois connection in common. But when you came, I know I had you in at least one class, at least that's my memory. When did you decide on the history major and how, and what was it? Were you already interested in history when you came to Gustavus?
I was. I had, for when I came into college, I think I was still in a place where I was imagining I was going to go to law school, though that very quickly faded. but history was always my love. I had a fantastic set of teachers in high school, including one named Craig Fonbrook, not that he's ever going to listen to this podcast. Who had this enthusiastic energy towards history as really a battle of ideas. Mm-hmm. I remember the first class, I think I took two of you, but the first one was HI 72, the American Revolution. And you introduced us to the Whig interpretation of history.
Oh, yes, yes.
and the Whig interpretation of history is a battle of grand ideas, right? Where the ideas of liberty are going to triumph over the others. And this great high school teacher did this brilliant job of challenging all of that for us in a way that I'd never been challenged before. I had been very fortunate in life. Schoolwork was never the thing that got in my way. I was always did well in classes. But I was challenged to think by this teacher in a way I never had before.
Awesome.
And it made me realize that there's a lot more to history than just knowing the when and the where. And the how and the why become the important stuff. So even by the time I got to Gustavus, I knew that history was going to be my focus. And after my first year there, I was pretty clear that my intent at that point was I wanted to be a professor like all you, like you and Byron and Tom and Eric and Kate.
Byron Nordstrom, my wife Kate Winstein, Tom Emmer, Kevin Byrne, Byron, Kevin, and Tom Emmer. They've retired. Still going strong in their own ways. Yeah, it was a great department, still a great department. What about communications? Was that something you started almost right away also or not?
I took the major. So how do I say this? I loved the major. I regret having done it because it took me away from other opportunities. I mean, it was a great major. Terry Morrow, when he came, I was in his very first class that he taught on classical rhetoric. And it was just one of the best classes I ever took in my life. And
yeah, award-winning teacher, great class.
Yes, yes, yes. But I also that year, senior year, I took a chemistry class from Tom Gover, who I presume is now long retired.
Right. Yeah.
And he made this point in class that I found brilliant, that the purpose of a major isn't to learn all the knowledge. It's to demonstrate mastery of a discipline. And yes. he was so persuasive with that, that I regret double majoring. Because I should have had one major and then left myself open to take more electives.
But yeah.
But I did love the, I mean, it was speech and communication studies at the time. Now it's comm studies. It was all good stuff. And I ended up writing my doctoral dissertation on newspaper history. So right. it was strongly inspired by what I did there. In retrospect, I would have loved to, you know, I took one English class. I wish I'd taken more. I didn't take any philosophy aside from the curriculum two program. And I would have liked to have done more of that.
All right. This is, you're doing a kind of PSA for current students and prospective students. Thank you. You don't need to double major. And yeah, Tom Gover, from whom I always thought it would be fun to take a course.
It was.
In chemistry. Yeah. I mean, he's right. I mean, that was good advice. Good. That's right. Mastery of the discipline, to the extent that you can master a discipline in 4 years. I mean, it takes a lifetime even. But yeah, and you know, I would think that communication, obviously communication is central to being a labor organizer or union campaigner. So then, you know, the writing skills you learned in history and communication, all of that has got to be influencing your, to this moment, what you're doing.
Absolutely. And it was also another very writing intensive major. And I am proud of the writing I do. I do think I'm a pretty okay writer.
You're an excellent writer, and I mean that. You are.
It's very nice of you to say. I take a lot of pride in it, but I did a lot of writing at Gustavus. And between my two majors and the curriculum two work, I really had to do a lot of writing. This is way too egocentric to be care for this podcast, but one of the things that happened to me between high school and college in terms of tests, when I took the ACT in high school, I scored highest on the math and science, the lowest on the verbal. By my senior year at Gustavus, I was scoring highest on the verbal and lower on the math and science. And that's because of all the, you know, the work with writing and language and thinking and critical thinking that I picked up at Gustavus.
Yeah. And that, boy, I mean, I always tell my students, we all do. I mean, no matter what your field, no matter what you do in life, writing well is important. And everyone on this podcast, every person in business I've ever spoke to, the nonprofit sector, I mean, it's so important. And yes, you do write really, really well, clearly, not just the content, which I enjoy, but the clarity of your writing as well. I don't know. Have you heard of Gustavus? You hadn't heard of, I had not heard of Gustavus until I applied for the job. Had you heard of it before the recruiter?
No, I was raised in the Lutheran church, and we went to a Lutheran college fair.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That was being held in probably by the airport, probably the O'Hare someplace. Uh-huh. And that was the first time Gustavus had ever come across. And I'd never heard of the king either.
No. Of course, I don't think I'd heard of McAllister or St. Olaf or Carleton, but I don't remember.
There have been family legend on the Norwegian quarter of my family that my great grandfather had directed the choir at St. Olaf in the 1890s.
Oh, gosh.
And so for a while, I thought St. Olaf would be the place I go, though it turns out St. Olaf didn't have a choir in the 1890s and he never went there. But that was actually St. Olaf is what brought me to that fair. And St. Olaf is a fine institution, of course, but it's no Gustavus.
Oh, we love that. That's great. You know, by the way, that reminds you, you mentioned choir. Did you do any kind of what's now called co-curricular at Gustavus? I don't recall whether you did or not.
I was in the collegiate chorus, which was the choir for people who wanted to sing but weren't particularly good at it. and I had a great time with that. And Joanne was in the G choir. She was in the
G choir. That's the big choir, right? I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you should come back and I don't know and lead the choir, lead some choir in. Actually, there's a really cool a cappella group, and I can't remember their name, but lead them in some labor songs. That would be fun.
Oh, there's some great ones.
Yeah, there are. So we're lucky you came to Gustavus, grateful. And then from there, when did you get the graduate school in history bug? Was that already by your senior year? I don't recall if you were applying then already.
Yes, I was. And again, one of these things where life worked out well for me, but in retrospect, I kind of wonder, would I have benefited from taking a year or two off? Because I know a lot of people who did, and it was a good experience base for them. I went straight from undergraduate into graduate school. And in some ways, that probably sheltered me a bit in the sense that I didn't have to face the real world in the same way. By my junior year, I knew I was going to go to graduate school. I was looking at catalogs. Senior year, I was applying, and I got into Illinois and decided to go there.
A great program, history and journalism. Also, were you working with? Was it Jim Barrett, the labor historian there? Who?
My primary field back then was British history.
Oh, right. Yes, that's right.
Mostly because Eric Carlson and I got along so well.
Yes,
and I took
a
bunch of classes from him.
Right.
But I very quickly. So what happened is I got to the University of Illinois, and I got there still as someone who would have described himself as a political conservative. I was my freshman year at Gustavus. I was a member of the College Republicans.
Oh, Dave, you're bringing back lots of memories, and I can't say they're all good, but that's okay. I'm kidding.
But I got to the University of Illinois, and there were these weird kids in the history department who had launched an effort to unionize the teaching assistants. And I thought it was absolutely the silliest idea in the world. And then, 3 years later, I was one of the leaders of the organization, and we were taking over buildings and going on illegal strikes and doing all sorts of things to win union rights. That was sort of the, and so then that led me to the classes that Jim Barrett, the great labor historian, taught, and he was one of my dissertation advisors, along with my main advisor.
What happened between College Republicans at Gustavus and leading that drive at U of I?
Well, I really do sound a bit like a recruitment video now, but it really was Gustavus, because the heart of it. I remember I once had a just hallway conversation with Chaplain Elvey, where he said, look, the heart of Lutheranism is critical inquiry. It's asking the questions and challenging. And what I found at Gustavus was constantly being challenged in the right kind of way, not mocked, not belittled, but challenged to think and to challenge myself. And over those years, I just, again, things I felt for sure that I knew, the sheltered life I lived in, in a comfortable suburb of Chicago, my certainties became more and more uncertain. And what I began to see were facts and reality. I'm pretty embarrassed that my freshman year at Gustavus, I wrote an editorial or a letter to the editor in the Weekly that in retrospect, I think was pretty homophobic. And I pretty much regret that. But I remember senior year, I wrote another letter that was very much supportive of the rights of all, to love who they wanted to love and supported gay rights. And people came up to me and said, boy, you wouldn't have written that 3 years ago. And I said, no, I don't think I would have. And I was proud of myself for having made the change. And so I was in an evolving space by the time I left Gustavus. I still imagined myself to be conservative, politically speaking. But I got to the university and I began to see the actual injustices that were being visited upon people who were doing important work. And I said, yeah, they actually do need a union. And then I found my calling.
And that was a successful drive, right? I mean, the union drive, if I remember.
In the long run, it was. We had to engage in illegal civil disobedience. We had to launch an illegal strike. But there is a union for those folks now. They won the election for the union a few months after I had left to become a full-time union staffer. They have a contract now that protects thousands of people. There are, over the years, tens of thousands of folks whose lives have been made better by that union. I'm very proud of my involvement.
Yeah, you should be. And the what you said about I wrote it down. Even my certainties became more uncertain. That's a great definition, it seems to me, of education, of learning, for everyone, not just students, teachers. I mean, that is the point. And I'm also thinking here, amid all the reporting and hoopla about what we can and can't teach, whether it's critical race theory or should or shouldn't teach. You were not made uncomfortable. You made a good point. You felt challenged, but in the right kind of way. You said not. You weren't made uncomfortable, or you weren't freaking out. I mean, this is what education should be about. It was certainly true of me. I mean, where I started out, even in high school, where I ended up, very, very different in my thinking. It's still evolving, right? We're still all learning, hopefully.
It really should be anyway. If it's not, then we're being too comfortable and we have to challenge ourselves.
That's the point of the podcast title, Learning for Life at Gustavus and, of course, beyond. So by the way, a little bit about your dissertation, which was interesting. I remember you reminded me a second ago, it was about newspapers, right? Tell us a little bit about that work, what your research involved.
Yeah, so I had become interested in sort of political communication. That is to say, in a society that's millions and millions of people, how do leaders communicate to the masses, so to speak? And so the Victorian period appealed to me because I was a fan of Sherlock Holmes. Silly reasons we come upon the topics we do. And 19th century Britain was a society that democratized to a great degree without violence, without social upheaval. It was a very incomplete democratization, but still. And I was interested in how that happened. So I wanted to look at political communication. And so I started just looking generally. And then I was reading a book from R.D. Ulfick's English Common Reader, 1957, University of Chicago Press. And how do I remember that? I have no idea. And there was a footnote in his book about these newspapers in Victorian Britain that came out on Sundays and had circulations orders of magnitude higher than the newspapers that everyone talked about, the Times of London, the Telegraph, and so forth. Indeed, the circulation of those newspapers, and today being the day after this event is a good comparison, as many people read those Sunday newspapers relative to population as watched the Super Bowl in the United States. And no one had written on them. No one had studied them because they were considered low status. They were considered the way you and I treat a supermarket tabloid today. But I said, this many people are reading these things. What the heck's in them?
Something's going on, yeah.
Yeah, and so my senior, was it a senior thesis, Gustavus? I can't remember if it was called a thesis or if it was called something different. But whatever it was, is I got some of those newspapers and I read them. And I looked at what they did and I said, there's a lot here. And so I decided to follow that. And so my doctoral dissertation, which has never been turned into a book, though there's been a few chapters appeared places, looked at sort of how cultural products get coded as unrespectable, and then tried to look at how they reported the news compared to their quote unquote respectable counterparts. So, for example, I have a really interesting chapter, at least interesting to me, on Jack the Ripper and newspaper coverage of Jack the Ripper. And the newspaper coverage of the respectable middle class newspapers was that Jack the Ripper was preying on these unfortunate poor people in this one part of the city. And weren't those poor people sad and terrible and over there? And what you and I, historians, we call othering those folks. And then I read these mass circulation Sunday newspapers. And what they said is, what's happening in Whitechapel could be happening anywhere. This could be happening to you and to me. And the police are more interested in keeping poor people in their place than they are in solving crimes. I know, a couple of years ago here in the Twin Cities, looking at media coverage of protests around a police murder, I found some of the rhetoric shockingly similar to what I read from more than 100 years ago in British newspapers.
Yeah, I bet. So this is fascinating. With the, for some reason, I thought you had looked at labor newspapers. These were not labor newspapers per se, but was there coverage? Were you looking at, was there coverage of, or you had to kind of read against the grain, so to speak, to find that?
Yeah, my senior thesis, I guess it was newspaper coverage of the London dock strike of 1889.
Okay, that's what I'm thinking of.
Probably. And I don't remember why I came upon that subject. I cannot remember now why I did, but somehow I did. And so there was a labor element, even though at that point I didn't consider myself a labor guy.
Right. Well, so that's fine. So this is what, like the 1880s or 90s when you're looking at these?
1880s and 90s, mostly some 70s, some early part of the old aughts, the 1900s.
Okay.
1880s and 1890s.
Victorian, basically.
Late Victorian.
So, and are you engaged in the union drive as you're writing your dissertation? Congratulations on that. I don't know how you did it. It's amazing.
It's why I became a union staffer, actually, when I started to work for the unions, because I was doing three things at once. I was trying to write a doctoral dissertation. I was helping lead with many other people. I was by no means the main leader or the sole leader, but I was helping to lead a movement to organize a union of 4,000 people. And I was teaching as a teaching assistant. And I looked at this and I said, one of these has to go. And the thing that went was the teaching. And I said, well, I can get paid for doing union and I can finish this dissertation, which mattered to me, which I wanted to do. And so I took a job working for the American Federation of Teachers in Pennsylvania, trying to do the same thing at Penn State that we had done at Illinois, though we were less successful at Penn State.
Wow. So that's really, that's amazing, your career. I mean, how you got into this. I'm thinking of titles here from College Republican to, in any case, you've had a long, well, 20 some years, right? I think in the organizing field. What, you know, and when I can't get into that, let me, I'm thinking, why don't we start with, you know, as a way of getting into that, why don't we start with Amazon, which is very much on my mind these days. I'm blanking on the name of a book. I think it's a woman author about Amazon that I've dipped into. I haven't finished it. This was some months ago I started. Anyway, let's talk about the Amazon, the efforts to unionize at Amazon, and also just the sort of the worker stoppages, one of which occurred, you can tell me the year, I'm blanking on the year, but it was in Shakopee, Minnesota, right, at one of their warehouses. And then the Bessemer effort in Bessemer, Alabama. Just why don't you tell us a little bit about your thinking about Amazon, the great beast, whatever we want to call it, and efforts there to organize workers.
Yeah. Yeah, and I, you know, because I am an historian, I always think of it in a historical context. Yes. And so, you know, for people who are labor nerds in America, the seminal moment of the modern American labor movement is the Flint sit-down strike of the winter of 36-37.
In Flint, Michigan, yeah?
Yeah, Flint, Michigan, the foundation, basically, of the United Auto Workers. And what it was the occupation of a particular auto plant, the Fisher Auto Body Plant number 2. And what was fascinating about that is that if you could have gone, and someone else's, I'm stealing someone else's idea here. If you could have looked anywhere across the American economy in 1936 and said, where's the one spot that if you organize a union, you're going to impact the entire economy, you would have picked Fisher Auto Body Plant number 2, given the centrality of the auto industry to American life at that time. And so in the modern context today, if you say, where's the one place you can impact the most of the American economy, a big Amazon fulfillment center is as good a candidate as any other because it is the nexus of so much commerce, so much you know, inputs and outputs and imports and exports and comings and goings. And it's such an important juncture point of our economy now that these Amazon warehouse facilities like the one in Shakopee, which saw a couple of strikes in 2018 and 2019, and the one in Bessemer, Alabama, where they had a union election last year and are starting a rerun election now. These are, Amazon cannot send these overseas. They cannot ship them elsewhere. And their business model, based around this concept of just-in-time production, where they do not have warehouses throughout the country stocked with goods waiting to deliver. They anticipate demand and ship it to these fulfillment centers so that it gets turned around and back out the door in 24 hours. And so these facilities are vital for any kind of logistics-based delivery services in our country today. And so they're incredibly important targets for an organizer. And on top of which, they're really difficult places to work.
Yes.
I covered one of the Shakopee strikes in 2019, and I met this fella. He was probably in his 50s, and he worked all day lifting 100-pound boxes, and he couldn't hold his arms straight. And he had spurs in, you know, bone spurs, and he had a slight stoop, and you could tell he was limping a bit. And he had to do this for 8 hours a day, every day, and often more than eight, because they often had mandatory overtime. And so you've got this combination of work that can't move, work that is necessary to the economy, and workers who are really not treated well in any measure of treatment. And that's a powerful recipe for labor action. And so it doesn't surprise me that Amazon's where that's happening.
Well, I like your point about why Amazon, I don't know if ripe is the right word, but why it is should be a target for this kind of organizing, given its importance in the economy and these warehouses or fulfillment centers as nexuses. You know, the other thing is, talk a little bit more about the work conditions. I've only seen what's the movie? Nomadland, where Frances McDormand's character, I think, winds up in a fulfillment center. That's it for me. I've never been in one. You've been there. I mean, these things are vast places, right? And my understanding, tell us a little bit about this. I mean, workers are what, their quotas they have to meet in terms of how many boxes they fill or ship in a minute or an hour?
Effectively, everything is quotaized. And again, if you teach your modern U.S. history class, you probably talk about Taylorism.
Right.
And the time motion study, where every piece of work is reduced to how much time it takes to move a box from A to B or to walk 8 steps over here. And so you have these workers are largely physical labor. They're picking up things, putting them into boxes, closing those boxes, sending off someplace else, or they're emptying other boxes and putting things away. A lot of the things are very heavy, and they are under a relentless time pressure. It's the high price that you and I pay for getting our stuff next day delivery. Someone has to turn that around in a hurry. And so there's huge physical demands, on top of which they don't get time to sit down. They are set a quota of how many items they're supposed to move or how many boxes they're supposed to pack. And if they take a bathroom break, that counts against their quota. And if they just decide they need to sit for 5 minutes and catch their breath, that counts against their quota. And there's because the dollar volume of stuff that goes through one of these facilities in a day, I mean, it's staggering. They can afford a whole layer of overseers, of supervisors, who watch these workers every move. A lot of this is also automated. There's a lot of artificial intelligence stuff out of it. But it's just also physical surveillance by supervisors who are watching every movement and docking these people and correcting them. There was a new report that just came out recently that showed their workplace injury rates are 2-3 times higher than other similar warehouses.
Good Lord.
Yeah. It's terrible stuff. And then you've also got some very particular things, like here in Minnesota, a big chunk of that Shakopee facility is Somali immigrants. And many of them are Muslim, and many of them want to pray during the day. And the facility, at least at the time I was there, did not offer them a place to pray, a place to do the prayers. There was, at least at some point, a religious discrimination complaint afoot. I'm not sure what the status of it is now. But basic disrespect for the culture of the people who were working there was also a part of that. And even though I didn't personally hear stories on this, you have to know that when you get in that environment, you also have sexual harassment. You also have all the petty crap that comes from workers being under the thumb of bosses. And so it's just not a great job.
It just sounds god awful. I mean, dystopian to say the least. The other thing, I mean, you know, you've seen Modern Times with Charlie Chaplin, some listeners have. I mean, you just break the body, you turn the body into a, or you try to turn the body into a machine, but yeah, it's impossible without breaking that body. It's awful. The other thing is, what about, you mentioned this, at least in Shakopee, the Somali workers. I mean, what about Amazon's record with respect to immigrants and, you know, immigration enforcement? I'm just guessing it's not a great record. Am I wrong?
Well, it is and it isn't, because there's this weird nexus where a company like Amazon, which has most of its corporate practices I find terribly abhorrent, is actually reasonably good on the very narrow question of, should we be welcoming to immigrants because they need labor?
Okay, sure.
And so they're all in favor of allowing people to come here and to work and opening up the doors for that. But there are all kinds of visa programs. In academia, you're probably most familiar with the H-1 visa.
Right, yes.
Which is effectively indentured servitude, because it locks the immigrant to that job. And if they lose the job, they lose their immigrant status. And that's something that Amazon has no interest in changing. Now, most of these warehouse workers are not in that circumstance. They have arrived by other means and came to Amazon because it's hiring and because there are other Somali workers there. And so there's a welcoming environment in terms of their coworkers. But yeah, there's always a risk in any kind of workplace environment where you have immigrant workers that the employer will decide that calling immigration in is a great way to bust a worker's organizing effort. You see this in meatpacking all the time.
Right.
Where the company's perfectly happy not to pay any attention to someone's citizenship status while they're working until that moment where that worker demands their rights and all of a sudden they care. And they'll call INS or whatever it's called these days
to come in. Really, really important point that you're making. All of a sudden you want your rights. Suddenly we care about your immigrant status. The Bessemer, I received a fair amount of press, even in some of the, like in the New York Times and the Bessemer campaign, which failed. And I know you've written about this. You've written, I think, a superb piece. I don't remember if it was in the Forge or where it was about that campaign and what unions might do better. And it came down to really the labor movement learning how to communicate internally. But talk a little bit about that. What went wrong there in your estimation? I know you weren't directly involved in the campaign, but in your estimation, what went wrong and what might the movement do to learn from that campaign?
Well, the biggest thing by far is that the balance of power legally and politically in this country between workers and employers has shifted so dramatically against workers that even in the best perfect circumstances, it is very hard for workers to organize a union. So if somebody who is, say, a person of color goes to work for Amazon and Amazon says, we're going to fire you because you're black, that person has a civil rights case that's a slam dunk, where they can not only win their job back and back wages, they can also win punitive damages. And there are also spaces where there's criminal prosecution potentially available as a way of remedying that level of discrimination. I'm happy that that exists. If the same thing happens, but the person says, we're firing you because you're joining a union, the only thing that that employer potentially faces as a penalty is paying back wages to that worker if they're found to have violated the law. But if that worker finds another job in the meantime, then the employer only has to pay the difference between what they would have earned and what they did earn in their new job. And the employer has to stick a post-it note up on the company bulletin board saying, yeah, we broke the labor law, sorry. And as a result, if you are of the belief that companies should behave in ways that purely maximize profit, it absolutely makes financial sense to break the law to frustrate labor organizing drives. And so you see illegal threats of unions, against people for organizing. You see threats to close the plant. You see union activists being fired. That was just over the weekend. Seven workers at a Memphis Starbucks were fired
under
clearly ridiculous pretexts because they were trying to organize a union. In Bessemer, the thing that the company did is the union election was a mail ballot, and they got the post office to install a post office box right on the property of the company. And then they put all these signs around saying, cast your vote here. And with the unwritten words on those signs being very clear, we're watching who's voting and we're going to pay very close attention. And you have no way of knowing if we're going to read those ballots before they go to get counted. And that was what they were found by the National Labor Relations Board to have done illegally. But you have all of this. So this is the noise that every labor organizing campaign has to deal with, is that you're going to walk into machine gun fire the moment you try to organize.
Right. And so just sorry to interrupt, but it seems to me what you're saying, it's not just that not just that labor law in this country is stacked against workers and collective bargaining, though we might think otherwise, but that companies also just willfully violate those laws. I mean, from a bottom line perspective, that's a sound strategy.
I came across some archives, I think from Cornell University, and they were the notes from an anti-union labor lawyer in the 1970s. And it's notes he wrote to a client during a union campaign. And he actually writes in the notes, parentheses, violate the law here, close parentheses. Like, he actually wrote that. A lawyer wrote advising his clients to violate the law during a campaign. And I don't remember the whole context. They got away with it. and they get away with it every bloody day here.
And there so, are, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, no go ahead. You go ahead.
Well, so you have all of that. And what that means is when you're going to try to organize a place like an Amazon fulfillment center, you have to do it so well that even if you're perfect, there's still a pretty decent chance you will lose because of their illegality. But you have to get everything else right. And that includes breadth and depth of organizing. That includes community engagement on a level very rarely seen. It includes bringing in, whenever possible, political forces to support you. It means time and money and resources. And very few unions these days have the resources or, honestly, the expertise of people who know how to do this to do it well. I am considered by many people to be kind of a labor movement expert. I could not successfully run a campaign at a 5,000-person Amazon fulfillment center. I do not have the knowledge and skill to do it. And there's very few people who do. It's very difficult. And so you add that to the environment we're in, and these are just tough campaigns.
I'm just sitting here thinking a number of things based on what you just said. And one is just the size of Amazon. I mean, it's literal footprint when you think about those fulfillment centers. I'm wondering if you are optimistic or pessimistic or somewhere in between in terms of whether a successful union drive at Amazon will ever occur. And we're not even talking, by the way, we're talking about the fulfillment centers, but what about the pilots, right? The delivery drivers, other workers. And then I wonder, you've made this point, I believe in writing, that listeners need to understand. You're kind of getting at this in your comments here. The actual vote is really, I mean, it's a very small part of a campaign, right?
Yes.
Oh, but goodness, jump into those questions however you want.
Yeah, because a union campaign starts with workers talking to workers about their work. And at some point, usually a union will send in organizers or will help folks out. And you form an organizing committee and you generate the issues that you care about. And you talk to each other and you educate each other on what unions can do and what they can't do. And you build more support and you build your organizing committee and you build more support. And that could take 2 years before you actually start doing things like collecting the formal authorization cards that require a vote. The vote gets attention because it's an institutionally visible act and because it's something that has a number attached to it. But a union campaign is usually won or lost long before any of the votes are cast. You should go into an election like that knowing whether or not you're going to win. I was very proud that the election we had at the University of Illinois that I was a part of, I had predicted, we had done such good organizing that my projection for the vote was we were going to get 1,175 yes votes, and we got 1,188. And I feel like, okay, that's the level of preparation you have to do. You have to know every worker and where they are. And so the actual vote itself is really a sideshow. And for the number of campaigns that start, a tiny fraction, maybe a quarter, maybe a tenth, get to an actual vote. Some unionize through other ways. There's a process called voluntary recognition where the employer can just choose to recognize the union if the union can demonstrate it's got a majority support. And that actually does happen, usually in places where there's already a union and there's some leverage. But the election is just one small step in the process. And it gets a lot of attention because it is an election.
Right.
You should know what's going to happen before that election.
Yeah, so really a successful campaign has already succeeded even before the vote is taken, contrary to what we might think, those of us looking at it from the outside, especially those of us not that familiar with what organizing entails. Now, you've also, clearly Amazon had the upper hand here in Bessemer for sure, but you've also been... I want to be careful. You weren't critical of the union involved there was what, the retail, wholesale, department store worker, something like that. You wrote a piece about it. It was partly about that union and how it approached organized at Bessemer. But more than that, it was about what the union movement, the labor movement, needs to do better in terms of communicating across what, across campaigns, across different unions. Tell us a little bit about your argument in that piece that you wrote, because I found that very interesting.
Well, and watch what I'm doing here, Greg. It ties directly back to the Gustavus experience, because it's all about critical inquiry.
Nice.
Yeah, right?
Love it.
We in the American labor movement do not talk to each other with the candor or depth that we need to at all. And so this campaign happened in Bessemer, and I have, I'm in the business, so to speak, so I have a general sense. I know some people who worked on the edges of it, and I know people who know things. And so I feel like I've got a pretty decent idea of what went on. But the truth is, no one on the union side is ever going to really know exactly how it went down, because the culture of the labor movement, not this one union, it's the whole movement. So I'm not singling out any particular union, but the culture is you don't share this stuff. You don't want to embarrass yourself in front of other unions, and you don't want to give the boss any tips. Well, I will tell you right now, the anti-union side, the anti-union consultants who were hired by Amazon to go in this campaign, they've already written multiple reports and have PowerPoint presentations. I haven't seen them, but I know they exist. They have PowerPoint presentations that they've presented to clients all over the country. This is how we beat that drive. And we on the labor movement side are tying our hands behind our back by not being as willing to share with each other the lessons of what works and what doesn't. You and I are both on Twitter. And one of the things that happens on Twitter on a regular basis is somebody will put out a tweet. Hey, can someone help me find a unionized X shop in this town, a unionized plumber, a unionized restaurant, right, a union hotel? And one of the things that always comes out of that is that there is no single listing anywhere in the country of what shops are union and what shops aren't. That staggers the
mind. Which is nuts. That's nuts when you think about it.
It staggers the mind. How is it that there are 14 million people in unions in this country and no one has a list? No, I mean you could assemble it, because it exists in 150 different places. It exists at central labor councils and international union offices in D.C. and in regional offices here and there, but nobody has a list. And that staggers the mind.
Yeah.
We don't know where our own members are. We don't know what organizing campaigns are going on. One of the things about that Bessemer campaign was that very few people outside of that facility even knew the campaign was started until somebody noticed the filing with the National Labor Relations Board that someone filed for an election at an Amazon facility. Like, we didn't even know it was happening. And there were probably union workers down the road who might have wanted to help and who may have been able to influence the outcome, who were never aware that it was even happening. And this is not a criticism of one union. It's a criticism of a culture.
Yeah.
That really, really, really prioritizes not sharing any bad news. And we've got to get past that as a labor movement. We have to be open and critical of each other and be sharing in a way that we can all learn.
I couldn't agree more. And one of the things you mentioned in your piece, a point you raised, which I hadn't really thought about, but is the long-term impact of this, at least the potential long-term impact, negative long-term impact of this Bessemer campaign, which is it's not going to affect just workers there and not just Amazon workers, but workers everywhere who see, well, gee, look at what happened there, right? Why would we want to go through that, or what are our prospects? I mean, that's a really important point, I think, and underscores the why it's essential for unions to do what you're calling on them to do in terms of sharing information. And by the way, have you had, what's been the reaction to that piece?
I think by and large it's been positive. Okay. Again, I circulate amongst a rarefied set of self-proclaimed labor nerds. And I think in that group, I get a lot of positive feedback. I'm not connected to like big actual leader people in unions, like the president of these unions. I have no idea what they think or if they've read it. Yeah. I would certainly be fascinated to know, but I haven't been told. But
well, I hope you read it. Go ahead.
You can see the opposite of this in what's happening right now at Starbucks, where two stores file for a union election and win. And now in the last 6 weeks, 80 more have filed for union. Like what, seeing one other group win inspires the heck out of everybody else. And I mean, nobody had Starbucks organizing on their bingo card in October. anywhere. Like, nobody had that. And now all of a sudden it's there's something happening there. The scale and scope of it, the speed of it, inspired by other people doing it. And so when you lose a big campaign like that in Bessemer, it has a chilling effect. And there's a lot of folks, and I don't know that I go so far as to say this because I try not to be, even though I'm super arrogant, I try not to be here. There's some folks who say that the union should have stopped the campaign before the election. It was better to not hold the election and walk away than to hold the election and lose. And There's probably a lot to that. Mm-hmm. I've done that myself in campaigns where we're going to lose so bad here that the right thing to do is to walk away, even though there are workers who really want a union here. Now, and that's the reason why you go ahead, is that there, in that Bessemer campaign, there were dedicated workers who believed in the union and who were committing heart and soul and body to that drive. You've got a moral obligation to those people. That's very real.
Thank you for saying moral obligation, because you used the word right. And I was going to say, I think you even use the word ethical in your piece. There's an ethical or moral obligation. That's right. I agree. It's to workers, not just there, but to workers everywhere, right? As you're pointing out in your piece.
Right.
But you also know with Starbucks, right, that it can work the other way, right? There's the chilling effect of a failed, unsuccessful campaign, but then the other way around as well. And maybe that's a way for us to get into kind of the labor movement at the moment. First of all, just tell us how many workers, a very small percentage of workers in this country are actually unionized, right?
Right. The latest numbers are just under 12%, but that is slightly misleading because in the public sector, that is people who work for states, the federal government, cities, counties, school districts, it's about 30-35%. For people who work for private employers, and that would include a Gustavus because, of course, you're a private institution, it's a little over 6%, which is as low as it was before the First World War.
Which is staggering, hard to believe. Now, there's a lot of talk, a lot of writing about the impact of the pandemic on labor organizing. I'm curious to hear your thoughts about that. And some of this, people go back, look at 1918 and, what happened post that after that pandemic in terms of the labor movement. I'm curious to hear you talk about or what you think about the pandemic's impact on labor, the movement, organizing, but also just broadly the prospects for labor in this country in terms of worker empowerment.
Well, so much to get into there. One of the things that, again, as historians we know, is that when you have crisis moments in the world, almost whatever the crisis, it creates both bad things, because there's a lot of bad things with the pandemic, but it also creates a certain breaking of standards, of breakdown of traditional ways of looking at things, and senses of possibility grow.
Right.
And so there's this sense of possibility now where workers who had never thought of themselves as having an opportunity. And so one of the pieces of that is the Great Resignation,
right,
which is the term out there. And it's not inaccurate, where people are quitting their jobs at a rate never before seen. It's about twice the normal rate. It's very high. And what's really interesting is that they're not quitting to leave the workforce. They're quitting to go to better jobs. And that does not happen all that often because workers, and then what's the line from the Declaration of Independence? Man, all experience has shown that mankind are disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed.
Yes.
And that's exactly what this is. It's people who are in a job that is stable and steady, even if it stinks, are often just going to stay there because it's comfortable and they know where they are. And so when everything is disrupted, it creates more possibility. And that's where you're seeing people leaving their jobs and moving new places. And that's carrying off for them. And then tied to that, I think, it's not a coincidence that the biggest strikes we saw in the past year were workers who had to work their way through the pandemic in person. Frito-Lay, John Deere, teachers in the classrooms. These are people who did not have the luxury that I have of sitting in my home and avoiding contact with anybody who might have COVID for days on end, for weeks on end, if I want to. They had to go to the factory and make those tractors, or they had to go and pack up my Doritos for me. And those folks have had to deal with that for 2 years. And you can see it in those strikes that they've launched, where they are just they've reached the end of their tether. Many of them are working forced overtime and have been for 2 years. And sometimes workers in those circumstances are just so beaten down and tired that they can't do anything about it. But sometimes they just, their anger gets ahead of them. And Starbucks is a not dissimilar situation here, right? Those folks are working, like people come into their place of business and they don't have a mask on and they don't have good masking policies and they don't feel safe. And so they're looking for ways to feel safe. They're looking for ways to feel secure. They're looking for ways to feel valued.
Right.
And it's that sense of value that I think really is driving what's happening in labor. There's a challenge we run into. As if you believe in the American labor movement, you're always looking for that moment where there's going to be a spark, because you really want that moment to happen. You really want there to be a moment where the switch flips and the workers show up and organize. And a lot of people say this is that moment right now, and I hope they're right. I am a little too skeptical to be that excited about it. But I also say, like, what's happening in Starbucks? That's really interesting.
Yes, it is.
It's really fascinating. And what you see happening in with teachers around the country and other school professionals around the country is really interesting. And the John Deere strike was very interesting.
Yes, it was.
And so there is moments here.
Yeah, I'm with you, actually, Dave. I was talking to Kate about this maybe a year ago, but you know, when all this talk about, or, you know, talk, editorial op-eds about, you know, this may be labor's moment. I am with you. I mean, yeah, I hope so, but also skeptical at the same time. The other thing, you know, that occurs to me, and by the way, I love your point about sense of possibility and sense of value. And again, you and I know this, but so many people think, you know, labor unions or labor strikes, it's all about bread and butter. No, that's important, but dignity, right? And value, being valued, not being treated like a machine.
Yeah, one of the things that's happening these days that I love is this concept called bargaining for the common good, where people are organizing their unions around principles bigger than themselves. The greatest example of this, I'm sorry, I know you had another question, but I love this story.
Go ahead.
The 2012 Chicago Teachers Union strike, which is a seminal strike in teacher unionism. One of the things they struck for, they went on strike for, was that they wanted their students to have textbooks on the first day of class. That's actually in their contract, in the union contract, that students get textbooks. They weren't striking for themselves. They literally struck so their students could have textbooks, because those teachers were saying, look, yes, I'd like to get paid more. Yes, I want better health insurance. Yes, I want my pension. But it also kills me that I come to teach and my kids don't have books, and I need to have that. And so we're going to strike. We're going to strike so that the kids in my class have books. That's something that's like the moral component of that is just fantastic.
Yeah, I love that phrase, which might now be the title of this episode, Bargaining for the Common Good. What I was thinking, the other question, just to, again, I mean, we could do a whole podcast on this, a lot of these questions, I realize, but I wonder, I mean, what do you think should be the measure of successful worker empowerment? I mean, is it the number of workers who are unionized, for example, or are there better measures than that?
That is an outstanding question. And I don't know that I have a great answer, because I think that's part of the question is how do you measure success? As someone who's an organizer, I tend to measure success in empowered leaders. I tend to look at people who I helped change or who I helped develop into leaders. There's there was a state representative elected in 2018 from the South St. Paul Cottage Grove area named Anne Claflin. And she was the president of one of the union locals I worked with. And though many other people, and Anne is a perfectly capable person on her own, I know I played a role in her stepping up to run for public office, and it's something I'm very proud of. And there are people who aren't even in the union anymore because they've moved to another job, who learned leadership skills, who learned to speak for themselves and to speak with and for others, who picked that up. And it's that breadth of empowered individuals that in many ways I measure in my day to day, but that's also an insufficient answer. And so I don't know what success looks like. I know that if we get to someplace like we were in 1952, I'll know that's success. But even that was limited in certain ways. You know, that the labor movement in 1952 was a third of the workforce that was also racist and sexist and xenophobic, right. and had some real problems in those areas. And so it wasn't perfect.
Right.
So, you've got to do all of it. And I guess I'd fall back to Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart's definition of pornography. I can't define it. I can't define it, but I know it when I see it.
Yeah. That actually is a very good answer. And I think, for me, I mean, a union, pro-union, I think unions are important, flawed as they may be, right? But I've just increasingly come to believe policy at the national and state and local levels. And to get good policies, policies that secure workers' rights, workers' dignity, you need good people. You need good leaders. You need to get them elected into office. So that's I'm at.
My job for the past year has been at the Economic Policy Institute, which is a D.C. think tank. And I have the honor of working with some of the best economic minds in the country. They're really smart people. And a couple of them wrote a piece a while back where their concluding sentence was, poverty is a policy choice.
Mm-hmm.
And while that's so true, is absolutely true.
That's an EPI piece, it sounds like.
Okay. It was by our chief economist, Josh Bivens, and one of my colleagues, Asha Banerjee. And poverty is a policy choice. I love that phrase because it's absolutely true.
And that's kind of what I'm getting at then. Yeah, I definitely want to read that.
Yeah. What we did during the pandemic the first year is we gave a bunch of people money. Right. We had this pandemic unemployment insurance where if you lost your job, you got $600.
And guess what? It worked.
who could have guessed that if you give poor people money, they get less poor?
Right.
The fact that this actually is sort of a mystery to some people is shocking. But these are policy choices. And one of the policy choices we could make is to do more to create space for worker power.
That's right.
And that would be a good thing.
Yeah. And we need to remember, like, and convey what happened and make sure it's not forgotten. That's a communications problem, maybe, or a PR problem. But yeah, exactly. Who would have thought, right?
Right.
As we're winding down, you just touched on EPI. Just briefly, two questions. What's your work there involves? And again, congrats on that new position. And then I'd also like you to talk a bit about your work with the new Brookwood Labor College, especially because it's here in Minnesota. Why don't we take, I don't know which one you want to take first. Doesn't matter to me.
Yeah, well, I'll start with EPI. So the Economic Policy Institute has been around for 30 years and is a mainstay of progressive economic thought in the country. And what really makes it special in my mind is a deep and abiding commitment to real truth. There are times where I know there's an answer and I'll ask our economist, can you put this in writing for me so I can say it to somebody, like, no, we know it's true, but we don't have the data to back it up, so we're not going to say it. And that level of honesty is sometimes frustrating, but is one of the great things about it. I'm not an economist. I mean, I have, I think, a reasonable working knowledge of a lot of things, but I'm certainly not an economist. My job is part of our part of EPI faces towards the states, and we have over 50 partner organizations around the country, including an organization in Minnesota called the Minnesota Budget Project, which is part of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and we provide them with technical assistance, with messaging guidelines, with coordination effort. So a few months ago, I think it was in November, you might remember there were some newspaper stories about the minimum wage in Minneapolis.
Yes.
Where the Federal Reserve Bank here did a study on the minimum wage.
Yes.
That came up with some disappointing conclusions. And so what I did in my job is I kind of helped coordinate the response of political leaders and unions and nonprofits and my folks in D.C. to challenge the flaws in that study. And I arranged for one of my colleagues to speak before the Minneapolis City Council. Me and someone else wrote an op-ed that appeared in the Star Tribune. I did a lot of kind of roundtable messaging meetings and conversation meetings. I passed out studies to people so they had the talking points they needed. And there's days where that job doesn't feel like I do anything. But the truth is that kind of coordination of work between different levels of groups and different pieces is something that needs to happen, is that people need other folks who can kind of help them get access to the resources they need. And that's really the basics of my job.
That's great. Kind of draw on all your skills. And by the way, that parallels exactly what you're calling for within the labor movement, right? That kind of coordination, collaboration. I mean, it's not exactly the same, but it's similar.
Indeed it is.
So
indeed
important. Go ahead.
And then the New Brookwood Labor College is a very fun venture that we started here in the Twin Cities, 2017. Maybe?
How old is that college?
So I think it's 2017.
Okay.
So the original Brookwood Labor College, again, for the labor historians in the crowd, was in upstate New York in the 1920s and 1930s.
Okay, and that's what I'm thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah, right. It was a idyllic sort of, if we'd had hippies in the 1920s, it would have been a hippie place. But what it did, it was a residential college that trained an entire generation of labor leaders, like the Ruther brothers, like Walter and Roy Ruther, who founded the United Auto Workers. They went to the Brookwood Labor College. Ella Baker, the great civil rights activist, went to the Brookwood Labor College. And so a group of us started meeting over at the East Side Freedom Library in St. Paul.
Oh, Peter Ratcliffe. And yeah, I know that well from McAllister Prof, retired history prof from McAllister. Yeah.
Yes. And we started a conversation of, could we build that spirit of Brookwood here? Because what Brookwood did was, the 1920s were a really bad time for labor like today is. But what the Brookwood Labor College did was train people so that when the moment came in the mid-1930s, they were there ready to take leadership. And so that's what we're trying to do. It's a fairly ambitious goal. But we offer classes that are designed to educate people into the working class. And so we have a track of programs that include labor history, and economics as if people mattered, and leadership and organizing strategy. We have electives on labor culture and some labor skills like arbitration. We are funded right now almost entirely by labor union donations. We don't really charge tuition, because basically to call yourself a college in Minnesota and to charge tuition requires massive amounts of bureaucratic paperwork. So we don't. So we don't have to, so we can call ourselves a college and not have to worry about the paperwork. And we didn't want people to have to go into debt. So it's a fun experiment. It's still new. We shifted the wholly online with the pandemic, and it's actually been great for us. We now have people attending classes from all over the country.
Yeah.
Because we're offering something that people aren't. And I'm honored to be the chair of the board, and I teach a class every once in a while on theories of the labor movement, where I teach them Marx and Luxembourg and Sam Gompers, and we dig into things, and it's great fun. And so I'm very proud of what we're doing. It's still early days and we're still very small, but I'm proud of where we are.
Fantastic. That's exciting. And it was the original, the one in upstate New York I was thinking of. This is fantastic. That's awesome. Congrats on that too. And I look forward to learning more about that when we get together in person. The other thing, let's conclude with your elevator pitch, if you will, for workers power. I mean, why does that matter in a democratic society?
Well, that's precisely it, is it's necessary in a democratic society, and we're talking small d here. You have to have, if you're going to have a society where the people rule, the people have to be, I mean, the old phrasing we would use back in the day is they have to have a certain amount of liberty, by which we mean they cannot be dependent for their livelihoods on forces greater than their own. They have to have some control of their own lives. And in this world with a corporation the size of Amazon that can dominate people's lives so strongly, you need some kind of countervailing power force for those workers to have a real voice. And the true battle of the labor movement is democracy at work and outside of work. One of the things we build at Gustavus is informed, engaged citizens. That's what the labor movement does too. There's some great research done, for example, that shows just being in a union reduces your racial resentment. It increases your voter turnout. It increases the likelihood you give to charitable institutions. There's even some interesting, though not totally conclusive, that it reduces things like suicide. It's an instrument of civil society. And it's an important one, because in the workplace, it's the only one you've got. And we all spend 8 hours a day in our workplaces or more. You need to have an instrument of civil society there, and the union is that place. And if we have them everywhere, we will have a more democratic society, we'll have a freer society. It'll probably be a sometimes more boisterous and loud society as we disagree with each other more loudly. But as I experienced at Gustavus, that disagreement can be good. It can teach you, it can learn, it can engage you. And that's exactly what I want to do right. for the whole country.
That's awesome. All well said. And I like the connection to Gustavus. Couldn't agree more. Dave, this has been a real pleasure. I mean, for me, the time has flown by. I can't believe it. All interesting. We'll get together in person at some point. I look forward to podcasting with Joanne, Dr. Biedemann, in the near future. I can't remember when we're doing it, but we will be doing it. So yeah. You're living out. I mean, you're just touching on Gustavus. You are living out the values of the college and the work you do. And by the way, this reminds me, you know, Kate Shaughnessy. You may know Kate. She's another labor activist. I hope to podcast with her.
Well, she has taught for the New Brookwood Labor College too.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. I mean, it'd be fun for the Alumni Quarterly to do something on people like you and Kate. There may be others as well who graduated from Gustavus and are now out there.
I don't think I knew Kate was a Gustie.
Yeah, she's a Gustie.
Somehow we never, I don't think quite.
She's a Gustie.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it's exciting. Yeah. There are at least two of you out there doing this work. Right. So it's been a pleasure. Best of luck with all of this, including your new gig. And thank you so much and take good care.
Take care now.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing, Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.